As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Someone who has written about the torrential rain of the world landscape is Daniel Yergin. He is vice chairman at S&P Global. And yes, the prize in oil, and yes, Brent crude's 115. But in this more somber Davos, we must speak to Daniel Yergin about the commanding heights that he codified a good 30 years ago. Daniel Yergin, in Commanding Heights, you spoke of the journey of communism. What is the journey of Putin?
Well, I think what we are really at an end of an era, and it's bracketed by Davos, because it was in Davos where you saw the opening up, the reconnection of what had been the Soviet Union and the Soviet satellites with the world economy, in one global economy. That's now fragmenting. Of course, no Russians here, no Chinese here, and it's back to a more fragmented, less globalized world.
How much finger-pointing has there been, both in conversations on and off the record that you've had, at Germany and their reluctance to move away from Russia in terms of their dependence on oil and
gas?
Well,
I even heard the German economics minister said it was a strategic mistake to what they've done for the last year and a half, a decade and a half, rather, and that he said in a matter of weeks, we've got to change that. So it really is a big change.
And meanwhile, going forward, do you get the sense that there is a cohesive plan to really move away and substitute those supplies, or do you think that that plan is still lacking?
I would say it's an uncohesive plan. I mean, Europe wants to, the EU wants to embargo Russian crude oil. They can't get Hungary on board, so they keep postponing it. But I think individual countries are going to cut back. And what Putin has done is he's basically, over the next 2 years, has undercut his baseload market. And that's why Russia's not going to be an energy superpower anymore.
Dr. Yergin, George Will, September 12th, 2001, wrote of our holiday from history is over. Robert Gates, esteemed by all in politics in Washington, has spoken of our holiday from history is over. An acclaimed infantry officer, General Mark Kimmett, says our holiday from history is over. You, more than anyone in the modern era, have written about this. If our holiday from history is over, what are we going to?
Well, I think we've moved from what I have called the WTO consensus, which is globalization, to great power competition.
Do you agree in deglobalization?
I think fragmented globalization is what we have. And it's the problem for companies, of course, multinationals. They've played by the playbook of globalization, but that playbook doesn't work anymore in a world that's fragmenting.
In Commanding Heights, you do a beautiful job of bouncing between the elites and the people. I remember, Frog, in the chapter on Brazil was just brilliant. In this regard, a great theme here is the elites are disassociated from the broader middle class, higher inflation, which crushes the middle class. You know the story and the drill. What's your prescription for institutions and elites to reconnect with their middle class?
Well, I don't think it's a simple thing. Obviously, inflation is so undercutting of society and builds so much anger. So I think that dealing with inflation, but you're dealing at a time when world energy is disrupted, food food. And of course, 70% of the cost of food is actually energy processing and everything. So I think these are still going to be very much, I think it's a troubled period ahead. And you're going to see social instability as a result of this in countries.
Is it appropriate that China isn't here, given the fact that that economy has such a massive influence on whether we get a global recession?
Yeah, absolutely. But they're not here because of COVID and because you'd have to go back and quarantine. But, you know, Russia, you understand, but the lack of China here is actually more significant.
And probably more of the reason why there is so much uncertainty. I was looking at a number of reports that came out, if we keep getting these waves of COVID, China remains in lockdown for longer, all of a sudden you have a very different parameter of risks in terms of the downside to growth. What's your view on this in terms of how much of a swing factor that will be?
Well, I think you see it because it once again means you get the supply chain problems again. That adds to the disruption, that adds to the inflation. So waves of COVID, if that is what continues to unfold, is in itself a deglobalizing factor in the world.
Learning here in Davos of the, I'm going to call it certification by the Philippine Congress, of Mr. Marcos Jr. You may know the name from many years ago. Dan Yergin certainly does. Huge debate within Philippine society of his resounding win over Ms. Robredo and other candidates as well. And some would say, not me, but some would say this has an autocratic tendency, a return to autocracy, as maybe we see in Hungary. I'll let you suggest other nations. How does a liberal society fight against a trend of autocracy?
Well, I think it is. You can see it in a lot of countries. I mean, the most important thing is actually elections, that people, once people are in power for 8 or 10 years, you're in a different game. And we've seen that. Look what happened with Russia.
Well, look what happened with Russia, but we're all hinged on the Chinese Party Congress, where it's, I believe, Xi for life. I mean, is that an important meeting coming up
in the late autumn? A central meeting, because it will set the course for China for some time to come. And obviously, they're struggling with party control, at the same time maintaining a vibrant economy.
Do you get the sense that the conversation around moving away from fossil fuels and oil in particular is taking on a new geopolitical significance at this Davos rather than just good wishes of people who want to do the right thing?
Yeah, I think it's cutting both ways, because it also means that there's much more concern about access to fossil fuels investment and the kind of preemptive underinvestment that there's been. So a lot of the discussions I've heard is actually you're going to need more investment resources, and you can't just count on a smooth path ahead. I think it's a bigger problem now. It's a more discordant discussion now than it's been in the past here.
Global Wall Street doesn't give a damn about international relations. None of them are at the commanding heights. JP Morgan's London desk models out $120, $150 Brent. Is that feasible?
I think you could have that happen. We see this market tightening right now, and if Chinese comes out of COVID and demand goes up, the pressure will be there. And the responses to that are going to be, there's going to be a political response, and there's going to be obviously a big economic response.
Yeah, but where does even gasoline prices go then with the refined goods, honestly?
Yeah. Oh, listen to your gloom.
Well, no, I mean, honestly.
Like Brent crude.
I know, we're running out of time.
We're having not only a problem with crude oil, it's a problem with refining.
Right.
That's where the real problem is, and that's where diesel, gasoline, all those prices. And, you know, we had a global refining system, and that's been disrupted, too, by as a result of Putin.
We're out of time. With the new map, Dan Yergin with us, of course, of S&P Global. Right now, this is a joy. Within the sphere of international relations, there can be vogues, there can be moments. And one of those moments was, I'm going to guess, 20 years ago, Fareed Zakaria with a post-American world. He says there is a revolutionary moment now, and a required read is Ian Bremmer's The Power of Crisis. Dr. Bremmer joins us this morning, of course, with Eurasia Group, of which we do an annual beginning of the year visit. I thought Fareed Zakaria was dead on about the moment we're in the power of crisis, except it's not crisis. I don't know what the plural is of crisis. You're the fancy.
Crises.
The crises descend upon us, don't they?
Why are you shaking your head? That is the plural of crisis.
No, I know. It's just the really.
She has to deal with me on a daily basis.
So carry on.
The many crises we have now, which matters?
Well, Russia-Ukraine is the one that matters to everyone here. It's also the one that's least well understood, because for the last 3 months, the focus has been Ukraine. But of course, the confrontation is also between Russia and NATO. The potential for negotiations to bear fruit, virtually zero. It's the first time in history that we have forcibly decoupled a G20 economy from the world's advanced industrial economies. That is a very big deal, especially for a forum that traffics in globalization. It is purely because of the acts that Russia has taken. And this is, I mean, the fact of the matter is not just a cold war between Russia and NATO, but there are elements of a hot war. So, of course, people are rather disconcerted by that.
Ian, people are focused on that, but are they focused on the right thing? We were just speaking with Daniel Yergin just moments ago, and he said, frankly, the bigger news is that China is not here because of COVID, and that that has a much more substantive impact on the global economy. Should we be more focused on a decoupling there?
No, because we are not doing a significant decoupling there. I mean, look, yesterday, everyone was asking about the Biden-Taiwan statement, which was much ado about the exact same thing that he said a couple of times already and that the White House backtracked. China, of course, is the most important rising power in the world, second largest economy. We're not taking any away from that. But the fact is that U.S.-China relations are very interdependent and they are more stable. Where Russia has just completely subverted a 30-year peace dividend that Europe has enjoyed. And I mean, I understand that I'm a New Yorker, but also we are in Europe. And so this is truly a generational change. That is what we should be focused on.
So how much is this an issue of supply chains, of food,
yes,
and issues with just what we're seeing in terms of a widening divide, if nothing else, in the quality of life between wealthy and the...
Oh, my God. The number of times that I have heard from people in the last 3 months that, well, you're focused on Ukraine because it's white people, because it's Europeans. You don't care about Syria. You don't care about Afghanistan. There is a point to that argument, but the fact is that the poorest people in the world are going to be vastly more impacted by the Ukraine crisis than any of those other crises that occurred for precisely the reason you just mentioned.
How much is this also an existential threat of the geopolitical order of Europe? And that's why you made the point, we're in Europe and people are focused on that. How much are people concerned about this trickling out into some sort of bigger challenge that is unanticipated?
Well, I mean, how much are they concerned that gas from Russia through Ukraine to Europe could be cut off at any moment by the Russians, by the Europeans, or by the Ukrainians, or by a non-state terrorist actor, for that matter? I mean, seriously, the vulnerability that comes from the mistake, the strategic mistake made by Europeans to allow themselves to become as dependent as they had on energy, as Dan was discussing, from Russia, is an enormous vulnerability right now. And furthermore, the fact that a country in Ukraine, there's a big delegation here right now, is fighting for their survival, fighting to avoid being wiped off the map by the president of Russia. And they're doing that fighting in part so that the Poles don't have to, so the Balts don't have to. The Europeans do feel that. Not all of them, okay? Maybe you talk to Belgians here, maybe they don't feel as strong about that. The Germans do. The Poles do. They matter. The Finns and the Swedes, who are about to join NATO,
right,
do. So, I mean, don't underestimate how much of a change this reflects for a Europe that for 30 years felt like national security didn't matter for them.
How do we support them? We had Alexander Stubb here, and if it's every nation for itself, a phrase, Ian, that you codified, from 800 miles of the Finnish border down to Erdogan with the Turkish lira through 16, and the incredible calculus he has with the Dardanelles, the Bosphorus, and up to the Black Sea, in that huge span of the new Eastern Front, how does America respond?
Well, $40 billion is
money.
One way.
Money
is
it's,
one,
is it's a
one way. Look, I'll bring back the Biden-Taiwan thing. When Biden says the United States will defend Taiwan, my view is what he's saying is not changing the policy. Biden feels like we're defending Ukraine. Not because there aren't boots on the ground. They're not doing a no-fly zone, but are the Americans defending Ukraine? I mean, when you talk about the level of sanctions, when you literally freeze half of Russia's global assets, the central bank, when you literally cut them off from the G7, when you support with the Ukrainians, with the intelligence,
okay,
with the money, with the arms, the reason the Ukrainian government still exists is first and foremost because of the courageousness of the Ukrainian fighters, but secondarily because of what the Americans, the American allies are actually doing. And if Putin had any clue that that was going to happen, he wouldn't have invaded.
Is an advantage for Mr. Putin the new character of American isolationism? Is it a different isolationism?
He thought it was.
He thought it was. But what is the character of our new isolationism if we're going to choose to engage in China or choose to engage in Ukraine?
Look, I think that if Trump gets the nomination for the Republican presidency, and he says, why are you sending $40 billion to the Ukrainians? Why is this our fight? Why would we antagonize the Russians? Which, by the way, his son has been tweeting over the course of the past few days. I think the view will be different than it is today.
Meanwhile, we just saw the U.S. Treasury Department agree to end some of the exemptions that's basically going to force Russia to
default
on its debt.
Right. People are surprised they didn't do that a month ago, by the way.
Correct.
Yeah.
But how much of a liability does this become that the U.S. is using and weaponizing the financial prowess of the nation in a way that it really hasn't before?
I think that the United States is showing that some red lines actually matter. Maybe not Obama's red line on Syria and chemical weapons use, but this maybe not, you know, Bush's line.
But is that how it's being perceived by the rest of the world?
It depends on who you're talking to. I think the Chinese are taking lessons from the fact that the Americans and the Europeans actually really do care. Certainly that affects the way they think about Taiwan. But you're right. I mean, the dollar is being weaponized. The American financial system is being weaponized. But you know what? Where else are you going? I mean, if there were credible alternatives, then I think that there would be a significant challenge to America's global reserve status. But if my grandmother had wheels, she'd be a bicycle. I mean, those are not useful comparisons.
Well, do you see any kind of move away from the U.S.? Does this basically increase the fragmentation that we're seeing and, frankly, the strength of the alliance between, say, China and Russia and even Saudi Arabia?
No.
You don't think so?
No, I don't. I think that the Chinese are angry, and I understand why they're angry, because they have a similar worldview with Putin. It's very aligned, but the Chinese economy is 10x the Russian economy. So are we seeing them break American sanctions? No. Why? Because they don't want to lose their business with the Americans, the Europeans, the Japanese. Right. Are we seeing them provide military support to the Russians? No. What we saw is that a China that feels antagonized and annoyed did some military exercises with the Chinese while Biden was in Asia. Symbolically important, economically useless.
The single biggest thing I've gotten wrong in international relations was the end of Yeltsin. What does the end of Putin look like?
No time soon. I mean, the likelihood that Putin's going to be removed is extremely low until after it happens. Right? Mm. I mean, clearly, if you're thinking about trying it, you're not letting anybody know, or it's it for you and your friends and your family. But the fact is that Putin is quite popular in Russia right now. And it's not just because they control information. It's also because they believe that they've been humiliated by the West for decades, and Putin is the guy that is saying, I won't have it. That's populism. You've seen it in the United States. You've seen it in Brazil. You've seen it in a lot of countries. If Putin leaves, that feeling of resentment and antagonism towards the West, towards Ukraine, it'll be someone else from the National Security Council.
I got 10 seconds. Yeah. How many times did you rewrite The Power of Crisis?
Since it had to go to press on the 26th of May, those last 2 days were very significant.
Very good. Dr. Bremer, thank you so much. Ian Bremer is with Eurasia Group. We will attempt to migrate to what matters. And with Scott Minard, who has been of such support to us in our coverage of the Federal Reserve, as Chief Investment Officer of Guggenheim, we are going to digress because we are 3 days in here and we have yet to mention the collapse of Bitcoin and the rest of crypto. This is a side topic for Mr. Minard. It's certainly not his wheelhouse, but you've been focused on it. When you talk about crypto, what does everyone else at Guggenheim think? Do they lean forward and hang on every word?
Well, yes, because I'm probably the only person who spends enough time looking at it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you know, Tom, I was an early believer in crypto. I remember looking into Bitcoin first when it was at $100. Mm-hmm. I did a presentation up at the Nantucket Project on crypto, you know, how to deal with it, how to invest in it. And I really thought that, you know, this is a viable investment vehicle. But one of my big concerns is that no one has cracked the paradigm in crypto. And when I say they cracked the paradigm, its use as a currency, right? As you know, the definition of a currency is that it's a medium of exchange, it's a store of value, it's a unit of account.
Not the last 90 days.
Not at all. And so we've learned that none of this stuff, stable coins, the whole bit, everything is suspect.
You're a really, really bright guy. I want you to explain the divide between Alan Auer at the Bank of International Settlements, who owns a high ground with Ken Rogoff at Harvard, on the study of Bitcoin and the entire scarcity, the derived scarcity of it, with the community of Bitcoin that just seems miles apart, and they won't read Alan Auer.
Right. No, well, I think, look, because Bitcoin and any cryptocurrency at this point has not really established itself as a credible institutional investment. Right, it's really become the market of a bunch of yahoos and backwaters, and I know I'm already going to be plastered on Twitter now for what I just said.
Good luck when you get back to your desk.
Yeah, exactly.
Lisa's cell phone just melted down over there.
Exactly. But you know, when you consider we have 19,000 digital currencies or cryptos or whatever we want to call them today. Most of them are junk. They don't make any sense whatsoever.
Do you have any crypto asset investments?
We did. We had Bitcoin. We bought it around 20,000. We sold it at 40,000. And I really thought we were going to correct. You know, after we got to 60, I thought we would correct to 30. We got there. And then I began to look at it and say, why are we stopping here? And so my latest work, which is entirely technical because there's nothing else to look at here, is that we were probably going to hit $8,000 before.
What was that number?
8,000 until we totally flush
so you
out
have
what's
no
going
more
on.
Holdings.
No.
Okay.
I mean,
well,
if I were, I'd be short, but
well, going
that'll
forward,
get me shot too. So
you've been predictably bearish for a while, talking
right.
about how you do think that the U.S. is heading toward a recession, but you've remained sanguine on certain risk assets amid this because of
right.
the short term. Has that changed as people bring forward the slowing growth narrative?
Yeah, it definitely, it isn't the slowing growth narrative that caused me to change. It was my time at Stanford a few weeks ago at the Hoover Central Bank Conference. And I saw current Fed officials, ex-Fed officials, and they uniformly were extremely hawkish. I engaged in opportunities to talk about the market and the functioning of the market and so on and so forth. The bottom line is that short of a sudden collapse in equity prices, I don't believe the Federal Reserve is going to respond. The words I kept saying is, as long as the decline remains orderly, we would like to see financial conditions tighten. And
right.
that I think, is the game plan.
In the land of Michael Boskin, and particularly in the land of John Taylor in the Taylor Rule, obviously this is a whole original architecture for everybody involved in economics. But if a central bank blinks, how is that expressed? Is it going to be expressed through dollar dynamics?
Oh, absolutely. I think if the Fed blinks...
We're going to make some news here. Give me a dollar call.
Well, I think as long as we stay the course on tightening, which I think we will through the summer, the dollar's going to do fine. But if the Fed blinks because of financial panic, which I think there's a high probability of toward the second half of the year, then I think the dollar will come under pressure.
What happens, though, if the Fed doesn't blink because of that, but because growth is actually slowing, which is basically what people are pricing in right now?
Right, but I think that for the Fed, the dynamic is not the slowing growth, it's the inflation number. Right. And the growth can slow and we can still have high inflation, which, you know, Tom is very familiar with. We called it stagflation.
No.
And I don't buy into that whole dynamic, but I'm just
right.
saying that they're tightening, I think, financial conditions faster than they realize.
Can you use a Taylor rule, given the fiscal impulse we had off a natural medical disaster?
Right. Well, I don't think so. And I think, Tom, what we're looking at here is more akin to the post-Second World War period.
So you're going to give me a 47 analogy here.
Exactly. And the analogy is that we hit 20% inflation in 1946. The Fed stopped expanding the balance sheet, stopped monetizing debt. Fiscal spending was reduced at the end of the war. We had supply shocks as consumers looked to buy consumer goods at the end of the war. factories were geared for wartime. And by 49, we had a mild recession. Stocks had pulled back 15 to 20%, and it went fine. It's the problem I'm seeing is that we're raising rates, and we're going to shrink the balance sheet at the same time. And I can remember sitting, I think, with you on Bloomberg back in December of 2018, when the chair made his famous statement that the shrinking of the balance sheet was on autopilot. And the next day, we were mopping up from the Fed, and the stock market was down 20%.
Well, I can't remember what I had for dinner last night.
Scott Minard of Guggenheim, thank you so much. And hopefully, you'll remember many more things from this meeting. I know that it has been very productive for you and for many people.
Joining us now, Neela Richardson, chief economist at ADP and proud mother. The trends here are international, but there's a domestic overlay. Mr. Gentilini, speaking of recession, I'm worn out by it. Brian Moynihan of Bank of America making clear, yeah, it could happen, but no. What is the official call of your esteemed group?
You know, I think that the fundamentals in the U.S. are still pretty strong. Whenever the Fed starts raising interest rates, the specter of inflation goes from the back burner to the front burner, and people are talking about it. I also think that 10 years of economic expansion has dulled our senses that recessions are routine. They happen periodically. And it doesn't imply that even a recession will be deep or long. But that being said, I think globally, there are going to be countries that have some really serious challenges. And the purpose of Davos is to go beyond the domestic and recognize that what happens abroad doesn't stay abroad. It comes back home.
So what's been the most notable thing that you've discussed while at Davos about that interconnectedness?
I think this tension around deglobalization is being dismantled. And so this is my hope. With all the concerns and crises there are in the world, when it comes to everything, even my perspective, something very domestic, labor markets, you can't stay local, not even with labor. If you look at the trends that are moving the jobs market, the real economy, over the next 10 years, it's demographics and digitization. Those are not local phenomena.
So we're talking about a lot of secular changes amid some of these crises that we're talking about, whether it's the Ukrainian war that's very much focusing the conversation or the shutdowns over in China. People are honing in on data that is starting to slow, soft data. Right. Do you think that that will be reflected in the hard data enough to really move away from some of the hard landing scenarios?
You know, the risks are accelerating, and I think every country has experienced the pandemic slightly differently. And so there is no guarantee that there won't be turbulence for everybody. We're hoping that there won't be crashes, but hard landings, I think, are inevitable.
That was my bad. But
was that your bad or my? As a group bad, folks.
No,
we call that
definitely
Davos,
mine.
A group bad.
I
continue,
own it.
Please.
But where do you expect the hard landings to come?
The places where the food crisis is most acute. So I know that we spend a lot of time talking about monetary policy.
Right.
I'm coming from the real economy, and nothing's more real than what you put in your
mouth. Okay, let's get on the IS curve. This is important. I had a panel this morning with Gita Gopinath Mazzucato and Jim Shade of Maersk and of Siemens. And I quoted from the New York Times in the paper this morning, 50% of renters in New York now pay over 50% of their income for their monthly rent. The middle class, and you, ADP guy, they know this better than anybody. The middle class is flat on their back. Is there a policy prescription you see in Washington to not protect them, but assist them as we come off this high nominal GDP?
The operative word in that question is now. I would argue that that's been a decade-long or more challenge.
Agreed.
That the housing market has been chronically undersupplied. In fact, at least New York City has, you know, subsidized rents in a way that most of America doesn't have. But it is a key challenge. It's a challenge that there used to be a housing platform platform around. But that platform was dismantled during the Great Recession, and it hasn't been completely restored. And so we do have a policy challenge when it comes to affordable housing, and it's everywhere.
How alone is Brian Moynihan? He pops to $22 per hour with a set of other initiatives for people under $100,000. Is he alone, or is that a new trend for rich, fancy America?
I would argue, yes, he's not alone. There is a trend, and I think we'll see that continue. But there's only so much raising wages will do to address the chronically low housing supply.
It just makes the rent something.
Absolutely. And in the short term, that's really, really valuable. In the longer term, you have to build. And that requires investments at a local level, which is a challenge in this country.
When do you think that we're going to see an appropriate level of wage gains? And I say this because, talking to Tom's point, people are now saying the wage gains are too problematic because they're going to just fuel inflation. What's the appropriate rate that we should be looking for?
It depends on who you ask, because if you look at the people who've experienced the greatest wage gains, that's the lowest quartile of people who are getting paid right now in terms of the hourly wages. They are actually making year-over-year wages, according to ADP data, of 8.3% year on year.
What's the middle doing?
They're keeping up with the inflation. It's closer to 3%, Tom, on the middle. So the lower, but you have to look at not just the rate of change, but the levels. What that 8% represents is basically less than $2 an hour. It doesn't even fill your gas tank.
Okay, this is important.
So that's really important in terms of...
Most important domestic comment we've heard since we've been here. What's the integrand, the length, and the x-axis of this negative wage growth? Are you looking out 3 quarters? Or are you looking out 3 years?
I think 3 years. Remember that even with 10 years of expansion, it took a very long time to see anything other than wage stagnation. It took a long time to see an acceleration of wages at the low end. 10 years. Mm-hmm. If you fast forward that to 3 years, I hope you see stronger wage gains than inflation, but it's not guaranteed, and it's not happening now, that's for sure.
We'll continue with Neela Richardson on our jobs day. When's the next, I've lost the calendar. Early June, we have a jobs day, right?
Yeah, what month are we in? Yeah, in a couple weeks.
Neela Richardson there with ADP. This is a joy right now, and it's a joy because you know the visibility of someone like Ray Dalio, and of course we gazed yesterday on the Dalio Goat Farm with Bob Prince. There's Rebecca Patterson, now there's a Bridgewater. They've got a full force complement this year. But beneath the names you know are really first order people. One is Richard Falkenrath, who was with us years ago, expert on Russia and security, and folded into that is sustainable investing. Karen Carney Oak-Tambor is chief investment officer, I should say co-CIO of sustainable investing at Bridgewater Associates. Are you and Falkenrath on speaking terms?
I love Richard, he's such a great guy.
How do you fold in your analysis, the geopolitics of what everyone wants is some better outcome in climate, with his dead serious analysis of geosecurity?
I think that what is happening now is that there's sort of a tough realization that to make progress on climate, a lot of the levers that we've put out there as the most effective levers are actually pretty inflationary, and that's more difficult to do at a time when inflation is already rising. And at the same time, we can't really think about energy without also thinking about energy security. So now we've gone from sort of a one-dimensional equation, bring carbon down, to a three-dimensional equation. Do it acceptably given inflation and handle energy security at the same time.
This is a critical question, and particularly I mentioned Newcastle Coal only because if I don't mention Australia every 15 minutes, I can't be on air. But coal is, you can't even do a standard deviation analysis on Australian coal. It's such a moonshot right now. Are you amending the Bridgewater ESG view, or are you pausing it, waiting for a place to restart the present ESG view?
You know, for us, there's two types of, quote, ESG views. One is just you can't really analyze any markets anymore without thinking about environmental, social, and governance issues. It's almost silly and outdated to think that you could really imagine what's going on in the world without talking about what are people going to do about climate change? Is governance going to work for us? What's going to happen with inequality? These are just critical issues. And then there's a different call, which is people increasingly coming to us and saying, you know, I don't just care about risk and return. I do want to think about the impact my money's having. And coal's a great example, because you might do great financial analysis and say, maybe I can make a lot of money actually investing in coal, and get the answer back of, actually, I want my money to be supporting the transition. I don't want my money benefiting off of that. So that's really a paradigm shift in our view and what we're seeing in global investors.
There's also been a lot of discussion about greenwashing this year, and Elon Musk's comments were very much in the forefront, where he basically really challenged some of the legitimacy of the ESG criteria. What's your response to that, especially given the fact that Brian Moynihan of Bank of America seemed to support what Elon Musk was saying?
I think that you need to think about splitting what's the point in time picture and what's the forward-looking picture. For point in time, we should just have good answers, right? The same way that we know if a company today is profitable, we should have good answers about whether or not companies are emitting and what they're doing today. And all these standards and SEC and everything, it's going to move us there. We're going to get to the point where we know the answer. But then forward-looking, you know, there's always been disagreement. Why do we have equity analysts? One analyst is going to tell you this product's going to work. One equity analyst is going to tell you this product's going to fail. That's how it should be. They should be analyzing what's happening in the future. This is no different. Investors are paid to predict the future. And if you're looking at a company and saying, how are they going to do over the next 10 years? Are they going to succeed in transitioning what they're doing? If a company's promising you, I'm going to get out of the, you know, regular vehicle business, I'm going to make all EVs. You got to decide if you trust that. And that's no different than assessing other things about the future that are uncertain.
So you were talking about the inflationary aspect of having a secure and, frankly, a greener energy system. It's not just energy, right? It's broadly across the entire ecosystem, the supply chain. And people are talking about, how do you make things more sustainable? If you have to look and see if it's sustainable in China, all of a sudden, you might have to pay people a lot more and do it somewhere else to do it. How much have we actually factored in the inflationary aspects of some of this shift in ESG types of investing?
Well, I think these are some of the forces, the secular forces underpinning the shift from deflation to inflation. Every investment we made abroad for 40 years was extremely, you know, efficiency producing. You got cheaper things out of it. And now, if we want to invest because we need to turn over our energy system, by definition, we're rebuilding what we have, and we need to do that in order to get out of climate change. If we want to rebuild because we want security, so we don't want certain providers, we want others, or we just want to have resilience in the supply chain, if this one goes down, I can have these three others, that's proactive new spending that doesn't create savings the way that old ones did. So these are secular reasons why you're going to get inflationary spending.
Karen, we have at Bloomberg Akshat Rathi, who's leading our coverage on green. He writes a newsletter called Net Zero, which is read worldwide. And his religion, off of his chemistry work, is it's science-based. Are the corporations that Bridgewater's talking to, are they science-based, or are they almost PR and policy-based? Is there science underneath the ESG of business?
I mean, look, there's a wide range because this is all changing so fast. So I'd say 2 years ago, the average investor we talked to would sort of say, it's great, you guys are doing sustainability, but that's not part of what I do. That's totally different today. And so companies are getting really increasing pressures from their investors. They're asking tougher questions. They have better data. So what was sufficient, you know, even 6 months or a year ago, might be something glossy that doesn't mean much. It's increasingly being ratcheted up.
Can you own big oil right now? Is Dalio up to his eyeballs in big oil?
I would say that in a strategy where you care about the impact of your money alongside risk and return, no big oil company has yet reached that bar, but it can, because honestly, they have a lot of expertise that could really meaningfully contribute. And so we could easily see in the next, you know, year or less, a big oil company saying, this is how we're going to use your expertise.
But how much does this moment challenge the move to green, considering the fact that everyone's rushing head over heels into commodities to protect against inflation, including big oil?
I think that commodities are a very important inflation hedge, and that the idea that you wouldn't own commodities if you care about the transition is totally wrong. Do you know how much we need to get out of the ground of things that are not oil, whether it's copper, lithium, iron, you name it, in order to have a transition? There's no transition without commodities. And so this idea that to be green, you know, there are definitely bad practices at some of the miners, but responsible investors should try to shift those practices, because there's no future without getting more of those things out. And the reality is, these are long supply-demand dynamics. It takes you years to get a copper mine up and running and actually have supply on. So for an investor that's seeing supply-demand pressures and seeing any inflationary protection, these are great inflation protection assets.
Karen, thank you.
Karen.
Thank you.
Colonel Tambor with us with Bridgewater Associates. I got a lovely email yesterday. As with the former Prime Minister of Finland, I tried to mention something most Americans don't know about, and that is the Winter War of, I believe it was 39, where 25,000 of Finland and so many others of Scandinavia gave their lives. This is front and center for the discussion of Finland and Sweden as they consider a new Russia. Mikael Damberg is a Swedish finance minister and joins us this morning. This morning, it is front and center, your prime minister, Prime Minister Anderson, with these very difficult decisions for a neutral Sweden, I believe, to 1523. How abrupt is this change for Sweden, knowing the history of World War II and knowing where we're going now with Russia?
It's a huge decision for us because we've been non-aligned for 200 years. So actually, we're one of the countries in the world that has been in peace for the longest time. So for us, taking the decision after the Russian invasion of Ukraine to change and to see that our security is stronger within NATO than outside, it is a historic decision for us.
I've never understood the politics and social humor or seriousness from the distance from Oslo to Helsinki, across in Denmark as well, across all of Scandinavia. I'm not informed on it. How coalesced, how united is Scandinavia, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Finland at this time of crisis?
Enormous unity, because we share borders, we share history. As you mentioned, Finland and Sweden was the same country for hundreds of years. Before Finland became their own country, they were part of Sweden. My grandfather actually died in the Winter War 1939. My mother was 4 years old when she was sent from Helsinki to Sweden as a war child.
What was Mr. Putin thinking, knowing that history? I don't understand, given everything I've read about the resiliency of the Baltic Sea and the people that surround it, frankly, including northern Germany at the time. What did he misjudge about Sweden?
I think he misjudged the situation in Ukraine. He thought that he could just go in, take Ukraine, and the brother people of Ukraine and Russia would unite in Greater Russia. I think that was a very mistake, because now they invaded a democratic country. They sent a signal, not least to Finland, with a 130 mile in English, I don't know the English word, but
now you're acting like me. Let's have Lisa.
A very long border to
Let's
Russia.
Have Lisa say
extremely
you know,
long
it's
border.
It's a historic moment with your bid for NATO. It's also a historic moment with some of the economic backdrop that you're facing as finance minister and the inflationary inputs. I know that a lot of European countries are turning to subsidies to offset the burden, particularly for lower income. What are you working toward? What is your next plan?
First of all, Sweden is in a different position. We don't have a dependence on Russian oil or gas. We have a 100% fossil-free energy system in Sweden, but we get affected anyway because of the joint pricing system in Europe. So the prices are very high. So this winter, we actually went in and gave support to households with very high electricity bills. And now we also have a scheme that we lower the kind of burden on people that drives cars. Sweden is a very long country. You have to have a car to actually live your life and go to work.
How do you counter the fragmentation of a system that is unified only by how high the prices are for everyone?
No, but I think Europe has shown tremendous unity, and together with US, on sanctions on Russia. So just 6 months or a year ago, people were talking to Europe. Can Europe unite? Will Europe split up? Now we see a more united Europe than ever. So I think this crisis has actually brought Europe together in a tremendous way.
Swedish economics is acclaimed. The contribution of the central bank to monetary theory and thinking has been there forever. Tell us about the Swedish currency with Europe. I mean, we look at Euro Swissy, we look at Euro Hungarian forint as a mortgage proxy as well. Tell us how you treat the Swedish currency.
It's the central bank that handles the currency.
It's in Davos. No one's listening.
No, but I could go to the constitutional committee to have opinion about the central bank in Sweden, because it's under the parliament, not under the government. But they have made decision to higher interest rate, and they have a plan for it, going a bit faster than the European Central Bank, mm-hmm. but a bit after the American Fed. So I think there Sweden usually are, in between U.S. and Europe.
I don't mean to interrupt, but this is too important.
Yeah.
Do you have Swedish Central Bank minutes like we do? We report our minutes 6 weeks after the meeting.
Yeah.
Do you read them?
Yes, and the central bank always calls me and tells me about their decision, so I understand it.
Okay, really? You're asking for justification for your
I've
not
never,
reading the
can
minutes
I honestly
with
say,
the
folks,
Swedish
I've never
finance
read the
minister? Well, we all know this. I know.
And say what happened.
He's looking for justification from the finance minister of Sweden for not reading the minutes. You didn't
some,
get it.
Some, several.
I think it's fascinating. Okay.
You
minister,
will read
thank
them
you
for
so
me.
Much. I will read them for you.
Minister, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A tumultuous time. Right now, and this is an important conversation for markets, is something that is in Davos, but I think in a really clumsy way. In Davos, painted on every hotel, on every wall, on every storefront, is a nation or a company bragging about infrastructure. We're going to build this, we're going to build that. Infrastructure is misunderstood. Infrastructure is something it's easy to talk about, and it's much harder to do. At Carlisle, doing it is a gentleman from Quebec Hydro of years ago in Montreal. Mackie Tall joins us now, Global Infrastructure Chairman of Carlisle. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. What is the biggest thing we get wrong about the ginormous infrastructure projects you're looking at?
Well, I think the reason why you see that everywhere in Davos is for a good reason. The world is in dire need of infrastructure. For decades, there has been underinvestment across the sector in infrastructure need. If you look at civil infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, our water systems, if you look at the energy infrastructure, if you look at other sectors, digital infrastructure, in the more recent past, the mm-hmm. economy has been fast digitalizing across sectors. That has been accelerated by the pandemic. That creates huge investment requirement in data, in data center, in fiber into homes and the like.
What is the constraint? What is the holding up of this? If Carlisle and others are up to their eyeballs in capital, why is infrastructure delayed?
It is delayed by the needs of old infrastructure, but also new sectors. The energy transition is requiring humongous, huge quantities of investments to be able to meet that climate challenge the Earth faces. I was mentioning digital infrastructure. So I think the challenge is the sheer nature of the investment needs. I think governments are doing what they can, but the private sector and private groups like Carlisle Private Equity Groups have a role to play, because we have the capital expertise and capability to also contribute to filling that gap. But it is the size of it.
How difficult is it to game out profitability of a company in transition that's sort of the sort of bedrock of a transition, particularly with energy?
Well, we take as a principle to carefully select our investment to make sure that every investment we make is profitable. We manage money for our LPs who represent private people. So we believe that that's present everywhere, in particular in energy transition, Lisa. I mean, the investment opportunity created by the energy transition, we think, is significant. It's possibly one of the most significant in the investment space.
So can you give us a sense of tangible types of investments and the possible ROI that you're looking at?
Yes, of course. Well, in particular, let's take renewable energy, which is an area that we have been active into in sectors like wind, solar, emerging sectors like batteries, energy storage in the form of battery. You have emerging sectors, which I will get into in a second. In that case, clearly, if you have the skill set and capacity to develop these projects, to properly locate a solar project in the right location, close to a load center, close to the right interconnection, where there is a good solar resource, you're able to generate with that capacity robust double-digit returns. As a result of that development and being able to deliver that project to customers that have an appetite for that clean power, if you invest in existing, already developed renewable projects, then you do not have that development premium. Right. And so you're investing into more operating renewable projects. In that case, you may be looking at high single digit, low double digit IRR, but more in the single digit, I would say, given the lower risk return profile.
If rates go up, does your IRR go up? Where are we in that continuum yet? Do you just see a longer rate, higher rate regime before IRRs adjust up?
Well, I mean, Tom, you're referring to the fact that we are in an environment where rates are increasing, where there is inflation. And what I would say, it's an important point for investors, is to face that challenging environment, there is a need for a diversified portfolio. And we believe that infrastructure contributes in a robust way to a portfolio that's going to be more resilient in that environment. The reason is are that these infrastructure investments, by their nature, where you have high visibility on the revenue, often if you take renewable project, the revenues are contracted long term with indexation mechanism in the contracts. So I don't think you make more money out of higher interest rates, but you get a degree of protection because your revenues are indexed to that higher rate.
Please visit us in New York. I mean, there's so much to talk about here. Macatel, I've got one question. We see the miracle of LaGuardia, world's worst airport. Finally, with a consortium of investors, there's optimism there.
There's optimism.
That we can refurbish and that we can rebuild.
Hasn't
quickly
happened.
Here. Yeah. Can Carlisle take on the Montreal Canadiens and refurbish and rebuild them as Canada's infrastructure project?
That would be, I'm sure, a project that, you know, the challenge might be difficult. I would remind you that the Montreal Canadiens finished close to last or last in the league. So that might be more difficult.
He wouldn't invest.
Thank you. You
in
would
words,
not invest.
Would not invest.
There's no, I'm sorry, and I'm Jean Béliveau, there's no internal rate of return this year on the Montreal Canadiens. He of Montreal, Macatel of Carlisle with us today. Now, without question, my most important interview of this Davos on Asia, the focal point of the South China Sea. Kishore Mahbubani joins us to say that he's Distinguished Fellow of the Asia Research Institute at the National University of Singapore, barely describes his contribution to the highest compliment I could give him. Even the people that disagree with him read his books to try to understand the swirl of Asia. Mr. Mahbubani, thank you so much for joining Bloomberg today.
My pleasure.
Has China won? What a provocative book a number of years ago. Give us the update we need. Has China won?
Well, I think clearly 2022 is a bad year for China. And partly because they're struggling to get out of COVID-19. That's a domestic storm they have to deal with. And then geopolitically, of course, China has also suffered from the Russian invasion of Ukraine on several counts. Just a few examples. Number one, as I said, China wanted stability in 2022 because they're having a major political conference later this year. Instead, they get instability. Their number one strategic partner, Russia, has been weakened. They wanted to deal with United States and Europe separately. Now there's been a consolidation of the West, which is obviously a negative for China. And fourthly, of course, they didn't expect that the Russian central bank reserves could be taken away so easily by the West. And China, as you know, the Russians only have $700 billion, but the Chinese have $3.2 trillion of assets. And these assets can now become liabilities. So 2022, therefore, is a bad year. But I think the Chinese have also shown a capacity to manage crisis very well. So I would say same time next year, when you come back, things will probably be better for China. And the long-term trajectory will continue.
After lockdown, And I'm thinking of Robert T. Kaplan's wonderful Asia's Cauldron, of the tour around your South China Sea, including your Singapore. After the lockdown, China feels they own a huge part of that body of water. How does Asia's Cauldron respond to China, and particularly after the election of Marcos Jr. in Philippines?
Well, the good news I can give you is that even though the Chinese have drawn a nine dashed line, which seems to imply that they're claiming ownership of the South China Sea, I can categorically say that they do not claim ownership of the South China Sea. Mm-hmm. And they actually allow total freedom of navigation through those waters. And China doesn't regard those waters as internal waters.
How badly does Singapore and the other nations of the Pacific Rim need the United States to show the flag with a dynamic navy and also with a reinvigorated base structure across the Pacific Rim?
Well, as you know, the reason why East Asia is the most successful and most dynamic economic region in the world is because the United States has had, this is, I'm talking about 50, 60 years, a consistent commitment to keeping that region stable and secure and allowing growth and prosperity. And ASEAN, you know, the Southeast Asia, 10 Southeast Asian nations, have done very well, primarily also because of the American presence. I'll just give you one statistic.
Please.
In the year 2000, Japan's economy was 8 times the size of ASEAN. Now it's only 1.5 times larger. By 2030, ASEAN will be bigger than Japan.
See, he has his hands move up and down, just like on radio.
Exactly.
It's great. Great radio with Kishore Mahbubani.
You're getting an endorsement right there. No, there is a really very real question underpinning what you've just discussed, which is the rise of China, maybe paused by the pandemic. It's been a very bad year. How far have they pushed out their overtaking the U.S. in terms of size of their economy?
Well, I mean, the Chinese economy has literally exploded. Let me give you another statistic. In 2012, 10 years ago, China's GNP was $8.5 trillion. 2022, it's $18 trillion. No country in human history has added $10 trillion to its economy in one decade. So the long-term growth trajectory of China, this in 2022 will slow down, no doubt whatsoever. But it will bounce back up because the Chinese have made massive investments, you know, in their economy.
Do you think that people here at Davos, the representatives, fully understand this at a time when China is not represented and the main focus has really been on Ukraine and Russia?
Well, as you know, Davos is like an onion. What you see in the open sessions and public sessions is what they're talking about publicly. But equally important, at the core of the onion of Davos, there are hundreds of private conversations, private dinners, private encounters. And as someone who wrote a book called Has China Won, I can assure you that there's a lot of interest in China and what it means. I mean, people know intuitively that within 10 to 15 years, China will have the largest economy in the world. And the world will be very different.
So how are people positioning for that in those private conversations inside the onion?
Well, I think what's happening is that there seems to be a bifurcation between the Western approaches and the rest of the world. And by the way, out of the world's population, 12% live in the West, 88% live outside the West. And most of the 88% in Latin America, and just give you quickly one statistic. 10 years ago, it took Brazil like 1 year to export $1 billion to China. Now it takes 72 hours. Okay. So you see that, see the dramatic changes? So the rest of the world understands that they have to adapt and adjust to a new China. And the more we can engage China multilaterally, and this is what we hope United States will do, in a sense, enmesh China in various multilateral arrangements, which will then, frankly,
do
constrain China.
Do they want to be enmeshed?
I think as of now, while they are still number two, I think they're very, the Chinese, you know, in the Chinese psyche, after 4,000 years of Chinese civilization, what they fear most is chaos. There's a Chinese word for it, Luan. And if rules give stability, they'll accept the rules.
We're running out of time. And this is so important, because I can't say enough about it. Mm. Do we need a dose in America of Kissingerian realpolitik? I mean, what do you need from America to change the dialogue where the fact is the legislature of the United States does not want to engage with China? So what's the realpolitik that we need to begin to look post-World War II, post-Vietnam, at a new Pacific Rim?
You're absolutely right. In fact, the central insight of my book, Has China Won, is based on a lunch conversation I had one-on-one with Henry Kissinger, where he said that what the United States really needs is a comprehensive, long-term strategy for managing the rise of China to match the comprehensive, long-term strategy that China has to manage its relationship with the United States. So it is Henry Kissinger who gave me the central insight for my book.
Kishore Mahbubani, thank you so much for taking the time of the National University of Singapore.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.